Climate change is already changing the views in our favorite national parks. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. This is ClimateCast. National parks are deeply embedded in our American identity. A new study finds national parks are warming twice as fast as the rest of America, and the changes are already dramatic. The lead author is Patrick Gonzalez. He's an associate adjunct professor in the Department of Environmental Science at UC Berkeley. He explains why the parks are so vulnerable.
National parks conserve the most spectacular landscapes in the country, and they happen to be located in extreme environments, up in the Arctic, at high elevations in mountains, and in the arid desert southwest.
Patrick, I'm a big fan of the national parks. I visited Yellowstone National Park 18 years apart, 1994 and 2012. I was shocked at the level of tree loss from the Black Hills all the way out to Yellowstone. You see entire mountainsides either burned or standing dead from pine bark beetle infestations. How fast are these forests responding to climate changes in the West?
That massive pine bark beetle infestation has grown to its greatest extent in 125 years. And in Yellowstone, it's because the temperature has increased at a rate of 1.4 degrees Celsius or 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit since 1950. Forests are responding as they do when they're overwhelmed by drought, bark beetles, and excessive wildfire.
So 2.5 degrees, right, Fahrenheit, are forests sensitive to that little temperature change?
Yes, because that slight increase in temperature allows the pine bark beetles to live the entire winter. Previously, the cold of winter froze them and killed them, but now they can survive the entire winter and sometimes have a second brood.
Let's talk about Glacier National Park. The photographic evidence on how quickly those glaciers are disappearing is stark. Why is Glacier Park so sensitive to climate change?
The temperature increase at Glacier is even greater than at Yellowstone. The rate's been 2.1 degrees Celsius or over 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1950. And the glaciers at high elevations are particularly susceptible to climate change because the atmosphere is thinner at higher elevations, so the air warms more quickly.
So what other parks are you looking at that you're seeing some of the biggest changes in?
Yosemite National Park in California. Field research has documented how human-caused climate change is shifting forests upslope in elevation and invading subalpine meadows.
So how is the National Park Service planning for these changes?
We're already using this data to help national park managers on the ground to develop, first of all, two types of responses: adaptation, adjusting how you conserve resources, and mitigation, reducing the carbon pollution that causes global climate change.
And how about people at the National Park Service, how are they dealing with the sensitivity around mentioning climate change given the Trump administration's views on the topic?
The science of climate change and its human cause is robust. It's supported by a complete agreement of all credible scientists. And the work that the National Park engages in climate change directly addresses achieving its mission, which is conserving resources for future generations.
Patrick, the study says a business-as-usual scenario would result in a temperature increase of about as much as 16 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100 in our national parks. Looking ahead to the future, what would that do to those landscapes?
That 9 degrees Celsius or 16 degrees Fahrenheit is the worst case of the worst case in Alaska. And the vulnerabilities of ecosystems in Alaska is substantial. Potentially increased wildfire in forests that are not particularly adapted to wildfire, melting tundra, and the melting of sea ice off the coast.
So which parks should people consider seeing before the changes alter the landscape?
All 417 national parks, which we were the first to analyze, provide terrific experiences. They conserve the country's most spectacular landscapes and cultural sites, but certain ones are more exposed, and particularly it's the national parks in Alaska that are potentially most exposed to increased heating. And then it's the national parks in Virgin Islands, which are potentially more exposed to decreases in rainfall or more aridity.
Patrick, what's the big picture from your work? The study's pretty comprehensive. What are the big messages that you want people to know from this study?
First, human-caused climate change exposes the U.S. national parks more severely to hotter and drier conditions than the country as a whole. Second, cutting greenhouse gas emissions, carbon pollution from cars, power plants, and other human sources can save parks from the most extreme heat and leave them safe for future generations.
Patrick Gonzalez, Associate Adjunct Professor in the Department of Environmental Science at UC Berkeley, thanks so much for your work and your perspective today.
Thank you for your interest in the research.
Leaf peeping. It's a multi-billion dollar ecotourism industry in many states. And there's one obvious question for the climate change elephant in the backyard. How do changes in temperature and rainfall influence fall colors? Lee Fralick is the director at the University of Minnesota's Center for Forest Ecology. Okay, Lee, we know frost is trending later in Minnesota. Overall, the data shows that. Does that mean a longer fall color season potentially?
It means trees are turning color later than they used to.
Okay.
And yeah, if it doesn't get really cold enough to freeze the leaves off of trees, we might have a longer season as well. And different tree species will be more spread out than they used to be.
And I was going to ask you about that because here we are late September and it seems like the trees are mostly still green in the Twin Cities for sure. When I was a kid, I remember vivid fall colors late in September. Am I imagining that?
You are not imagining that. I was just up to Ely over the weekend and most of the trees are still green there, which is amazing because they used to have fall color at Labor Day.
What are the biggest things we know about fall color and climate change?
There's a direct carbon dioxide effect that allows the trees to persist a little bit into cooler weather than they used to, but also the fact that the cooler weather comes later. We need several nights where it's down in the 40s to kind of make the trees decide to quit producing chlorophyll and reveal those fall colors, and that occurs later than it used to because nighttime temperatures have risen more than daytime temperatures with the changing climate.
So what's the biggest driver of fall colors? Is it temperature or is it daylight or is it some other factor?
Well, for the orange and yellow, it's really the temperature. When the days get short, the temperatures get cool, the trees stop making chlorophyll, which is made continuously through the summer. And as the chlorophyll in the leaf degrades, it reveals the carotenes, which are yellow and orange pigments underneath. Now, the red colors are a whole different story. Those are anthocyanins, and those are manufactured as new pigments after the chlorophyll goes, and that needs cool days and bright sunlight because the chemical reaction is catalyzed by sunlight.
So how is a warmer climate changing tree species in different parts of Minnesota, and how might that affect fall colors in different parts of the state?
Okay, well, northern Minnesota, maples and oaks are invading quite rapidly right now. So in places like Ely, now and in the future, fall colors will be brighter than they used to be because maple's going to have more oranges and reds compared to the birch and aspen, which was all yellow.
So I'll bet the Ely Chamber of Commerce is very happy to hear that.
Well, yes.
What tips do you have for us as we, you know, try and find the best fall color viewing in Minnesota?
Well, the best fall color, in my opinion, is the sugar maple areas. And so if you go up the North Shore, Crosby Manitou State Park, which is kind of up in the hills behind Tetegoosh State Park, on top of the ridge on the North Shore has the most maple. And then in southern Minnesota, it's basically the north sides of the hills in the Driftless area where you have all those big hills, the Big Woods area. That's where you find the most sugar maple trees, which are our brightest colored tree in Minnesota.
It seems like every year, Lee, we have great fall colors in Minnesota. I mean, I've been here most of my life. I can't remember a bad year. Isn't it pretty hard to mess up fall colors in Minnesota?
I've seen it happen a few times when we had an extreme drought in September and early October, or when we had a period of really hot weather, then a period of cold weather, then another period of really hot weather, and the trees were just confused. They started to go into fall, then came back to summer, started to go into fall, and just said, we give up, we're just going to turn brown. I'm a little worried that with a warmer climate, that might happen more often in the future.
So we've had an interesting temperature and rainfall pattern this year. The big question, what's your prediction for fall colors across Minnesota this fall?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask that. Trees don't follow my commands, but the fact that we had good rain in the late part of the summer should lead to good fall colors because the trees are healthy. They have lots of sugar in the leaves, and that's what you need to make those red colors.
And that's what we love in Minnesota. Lee Frelick, director with the University of Minnesota Center for Forest Ecology, thanks for sharing your colorful perspective today.
You are welcome.
It was a good summer for grapes in Minnesota. Summer temperatures ran 2.6 degrees warmer than average in the Twin Cities this summer. John Thule is the vineyard manager with the University of Minnesota Horticultural Research Center in Chanhassen. He tells me Minnesota's wine grapes do very well in warm summers. It looks like the extra summer heat this year may make 2018 one of the best years for wine in Minnesota history. And now, this week's climate story.
I'm Scott Rawl. I live in Worthington, Minnesota, and have an objective of trying to leave the planet just a little bit better than I found it. My initiation into the world of conservation didn't really start out as a desire to be a conservationist. My son was 10 years old. He said, Dad, take me hunting. I want to go hunting. But there was really no place to go. And so there was a new organization that had started in Nobles County called Nobles County Pheasants Forever in 1984. And I joined them because they actually were buying property for public use. And that interested me greatly. And so I joined them, my son came along, we started hunting. And after I did that for a while, you know, we got better at it, got some hunting dogs. And I said, you know, there's more to this than just shooting roosters or harvesting game. And I got interested in the environment and the ecosystem, which was prairie grasslands. And, you know, after it was find a place to hunt, take your kid hunting, then it was what else can be done? You know, trying to take the spots on the planet that should be in habitat and putting those back to habitat while still understanding that we live in an ag economic region of southwest Minnesota, those two have to partner together. And so now we're working on the balance between conservation and clean water, pollinators, places for kids and people to go, along with making a living at the same time. So when I was thinking about climate change here in southwest Minnesota, I said, you know, I'm really in love with grasslands and prairie ecosystems, you know, and I think a lot of things that live there would actually be a little better off with milder winters. You know, pheasants and game birds often suffer in severe winters, and so I thought, I know if we have shorter winters and a little longer growing season, a lot of the things that I like might benefit from that. But the last 5 years have dramatically changed my attitude in that regard, because we've gone from severe winters and normal springs, which wildlife can weather or suffer through or survive through, to gentle winters and then really, really dramatic climate events in the spring where we get 6-inch rains twice a week. You know, I mean, back when you used to get 1.5 inches every 2 weeks and, you know, it was great. We get lots of moisture now. It all just comes in lots and lots of big events that are very close together. And so I've kind of come to the conclusion that a stiff winter and a normal spring is actually better for the things I care about than a really gentle winter and a really harsh spring with severe rainfall events in it. So my attitude about climate change is evolving in the fact that I thought maybe the things that you know, the wildlife that I am involved with would benefit, but in actual reality, they're not. I guess if there's a message that I spend, that's probably the most important to me, that I spend my time, is to try to get individuals and people in groups to go out and actually spend some time outside, learn what those prairie and grassland ecosystems are like, slow down, look at it, watch it, see it, and then try to help them develop their own appreciation for it. Different people love different things about the outdoors. I don't expect that they will all share my exact favorites, but if we can get people outside, get them to slow down and spend some time in the outdoors, I think that will bode well for conservation in our environment going forward.
There's news from Denmark of a new international climate center on the country's west coast. The $8 million building is part of the Coast to Coast Climate Challenge, a six-year-long climate awareness initiative. The Climatorium is designed to attract experts and companies focused on creating jobs and spurring economic growth through climate solutions. That's ClimateCast this week. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner.